Welcome to Beyond the Bench, the podcast produced by the North Carolina Judicial College at the UNC School of Government. I'm your host, Jeff Welty, director of the North Carolina Judicial College and a faculty member here at the school. Our goal is to bring you interesting interviews with people who work in or with the court system, including judges, lawyers, academics, and others. This first season of Beyond the Bench focuses on criminal justice. On today's show, I interview two of my colleagues. First, I talk with Professor Chris McLaughlin about the ethics rules that limit how lawyers and judges may use social media. Then, after a break, I interview Professor Freda Bluestein about whether recordings made by body cameras worn by law enforcement officers qualify as public records under North Carolina law. Be sure to stay tuned at the end of the podcast to hear a bit about what we have in store for our next episode. Enjoy the interviews. This is Jeff Welty at the School of Government. I'm here with my colleague, Chris McLaughlin, our expert on legal ethics. Chris, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. So we're going to talk a little bit about social media and how the legal ethics rules apply to lawyers and judges' use of social media. But first, I'd like it if you'd introduce yourself a bit to our listeners who may not be familiar with you since most of your work is outside the courts group here at the school.
Sure. So my name is Chris McLaughlin. Again, I'm a faculty member here at the School of Government. Most of my work focuses on local government finance and local taxation. So I work with lots of local government attorneys, county attorneys, city attorneys, and the like. I don't spend a lot of time with judges or attorneys in the judicial system for the most part. However, one of my areas of expertise is legal ethics, not only for local government lawyers, but for all government lawyers, regardless of practice area.
And Chris, you and I share the good fortune of having gone to a wonderful private law school right here in the Triangle and working for a wonderful public university.
Indeed, it is, especially during basketball season, fun to have both of those connections.
It is, and as we're recording this, we're about to start the NCAA tournament, so give us your prediction for how deep the Blue Devils and Tar Heels will go.
Blue Devils, Sweet 16 at best. The Tar Heels will go to the final game, but lose in excruciatingly painful fashion.
Ouch. Okay, with that prognostication in mind, Chris, let's talk legal ethics. My first question for you is it okay for lawyers to use social media, Facebook, or what have you, to investigate opposing parties and witnesses in a pending action? Can they go online, see what's on their profile, that kind of stuff?
Yes, but with caution. So first, I want to make a general observation is that we don't have any special legal ethics rules that focus specifically on the use of social media or the internet. In general, all the same restrictions that apply to lawyers' activities in real life, offline, person-to-person, face-to-face, also apply to those lawyers' activities when they are online. So specifically for investigations during a case. We have two rules, the North Carolina rules that also mirror the model rules from the ABA, Rule 4.2 and Rule 4.3, which talk about and limit and prohibit attorneys from contacting represented parties without first talking to the attorney representing that party, and limit interactions with unrepresented parties whose interests might be adverse to your clients. You cannot mislead that unrepresented party to think that you are all on the same side and everybody's friends here and we're all working toward the same goal.
So seeing what you can see on social media is okay, but sort of posing as a friend might be questionable because it would violate the rule against contact or no?
Exactly. Friend requests to a represented party are absolutely forbidden. Because why? You are reaching out, directly contacting that represented party without going through the attorney. Now, unrepresented parties, a friend request is probably going to be okay, but however, some jurisdictions, not yet North Carolina, some jurisdictions have said you need to be very clear about what the purpose of that inquiry is. You are not reaching out just because you want to be buddies with that person. You are reaching out to that individual on Facebook because you want information about a particular piece of litigation or investigation. You need to identify yourself perhaps as a lawyer and let them know why you're reaching out to them. An absolute no-no would be perhaps to use an assumed name or to ask your paralegal to send a friend request, because then you're clearly disguising your entity and disguising your relationship with this potential litigation.
What about contact with prospective jurors? Is it going to be treated the same way? Is there more latitude? Is there less latitude?
Probably less latitude. A friend request, absolutely a problem. Because that is ex parte contact with jurors, no can do. But simply viewing their public posts on Instagram or Facebook or what have you is permissible. Someone has described the same as you can drive down the street on which a juror lives, but you couldn't go up and ring the doorbell.
Beautiful. So what about lawyers' use of social media from a marketing perspective? For example, can the lawyer post on Twitter, I just won my third DWI trial in a row, or can they put on Facebook, celebrating today, got a huge verdict in my personal injury case?
Sure. Again, the same restrictions that apply to advertising in any other medium, which might be television or print or radio, are going to apply what you do on your social media. Even if you view your social media as primarily your personal Facebook page or your personal Instagram, whatever you post on there is viewable at some level by the general public, and that is going to be considered advertising. So you need to be careful. You can't promise the same result from one client to another. I just got John Smith $1 million and I can do that for you. That would be a problem when you do that on the radio or on Facebook. Same concerns. You can't brag about skills you don't have. You can't promise to influence judges or influence public officials to benefit your clients. And you can't promise the same results for one client that you got for another.
So more generally, what about commenting about pending cases online, either while the case is happening or after it concludes? Is there any general guidance that you can give lawyers about what they can and can't say or how they should or shouldn't conduct their business online?
Yeah, my answer is if it's a pending case, you should not be commenting on that. There are loads of examples from across the country of both judges, specifically judges, but also attorneys getting in trouble for doing exactly that, posting what appear to be obnoxious comments. They don't appear to be kind of gain any advantage or influence the outcome, but disciplinary authorities have said, you know what, you might have. So you shouldn't be talking about evidence that was introduced that day or how you were sentencing a difficult defendant today, because folks can readers could view that as you demonstrating some sort of bias for or against particular parties.
So one of the great things about social media is that it allows us to show our personality a little bit. We can vent our frustrations, we can be snarky or humorous. But I take it from what you're saying that when a lawyer uses social media, they really can't think of it as a conversation with friends at a dinner table. They have to think of it as a public-facing communication that might be scrutinized under the rules of professional conduct.
I think absolutely. And we used to talk about, you know, do you want to see that comment on the front page of the New York Times? I think nowadays, well, do you want to see that, you know, on the front page of CNN.com or tweet it out to half a million tweeting customers? Because that's possible today, right? Whatever you put out, even just to one person, certainly can be retweeted or reposted ad infinitum. And we've seen a number of examples of lawyers getting in trouble tweeting to their friends. And maybe they only have 15 or 25 tweeting friends, Twitter contacts. But you know what? Those people have Twitter contacts, and so do the other people, and so do the other people, and so on and so on.
Followers is what I think they call
followers. Days, clearly, I'm in the wrong generation.
So we've talked about Twitter, we've talked about Facebook. Let me turn and ask you a question about LinkedIn, which is an area where we actually have a formal ethics opinion from the state bar. The basic question that I'm going to ask you is it okay for lawyers and judges to connect on LinkedIn?
Yes, in general. But again, there are some concerns. There are some caveats. So the ethics opinion we're talking about here is from 2014 Formal Ethics Opinions 8. And that talks about – it walks through a number of questions related to what you can and cannot do on LinkedIn. So in general, the rules shake out as follows. Perfectly appropriate for lawyers to be connected with or endorse other lawyers on LinkedIn. It is acceptable for a judge to endorse or be connected to lawyers on LinkedIn. The problem is when judges begin to endorse lawyers on LinkedIn. That is a problem because you cannot, of course, show bias or partiality toward a particular lawyer. If a lawyer wants to endorse a judge on LinkedIn, absolutely okay. You can be connected to the judges. You can communicate with judges via LinkedIn, but not during a pending case because, of course, we've got the rules against ex parte conduct, contact, and a LinkedIn communication would certainly qualify as one of those. If a lawyer were to receive a connected request on LinkedIn during a pending case from a judge, my advice would be turn that down, perhaps even explain why, and then when the case is over, come back and accept that invitation.
So let me see if I've got it right. I can be a judge's friend in real life. I can be a judge's friend on Facebook. I can connect with a judge on LinkedIn. But if I accept anything from a judge that indicates an endorsement of me, that raises a concern that I'm claiming some special connection or special ability to influence the judge above and beyond what other lawyers can do. And the state bar says that's a no-no.
Absolutely. In fact, the state bar suggests that it might be okay initially because lawyer A and lawyer B are both lawyers. Nobody's a judge. They can endorse each other. But yet suddenly lawyer A gets appointed to or elected to the bench. Now lawyer B has an endorsement from a judge on his or her LinkedIn page. That's a problem. You need to go back and clean that up after the fact.
Wow. Okay. Last question for you. We're in election season right now, and are there any limits about what judges can say on social media during their campaigns? Can they have a campaign-related social media site? Can they endorse other candidates for office in connection with social media? What can they do? What can they not do?
Very clearly, you can have a Facebook site, a LinkedIn site, et cetera, in support of your campaign. You can list the folks who have been donating to you. You can list the folks who support you. That's not a problem. However, supporting other political candidates, there are restrictions on that, and I would be concerned about judges getting too involved in other people's candidacies. Absolutely. Promoting your own candidacy, not a problem at all, whether you do that in traditional fundraising dinners or you do that on Facebook.
And Chris, I said that was my last question, but I do have one more. As we sit here across from each other at my desk, I see that you have in front of you your own blog post on this that appeared both on the Coates Cannons blog and the North Carolina Criminal Law blog. And then you've got another resource in your hands. What is that other resource?
Yes, so I would heartily recommend, especially for judges, to read a bulletin put out by our colleague, Michael Crowell, who posted this back just a few months ago in December of 2015. It is Administration of Justice Bulletin number 2015/09. But it's entitled Judicial Ethics and Social Media. And Michael does a wonderful job of reviewing the rather paltry North Carolina opinions and rules that might connect social media, but does a great job nationally looking through all the opinions and really giving you a good snapshot of where the trends are moving nationally.
Sounds like a page turner. Chris, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This is your host, Jeff Welty, back again. That concludes my interview with Chris McLaughlin. But today's show is a two-for-one special. In the second segment of this episode, I talk with Professor Freda Bluestein about whether body camera recordings are public records. Hope you enjoy it.
This is Jeff Welty at the School of Government, and I'm here with my colleague Freda Bluestein, who's an expert on the state's public records law. Freda, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
We are going to talk about body-worn cameras, which are a part of our current national conversation about relationships between communities and police, and specifically about whether there is a right of public access to the footage generated by body-worn cameras. I guess my first question is, some people see this as a slam dunk. The whole purpose of body-worn cameras is transparency so that we can see what the police are up to. Why isn't it just an easy question where everything that's recorded is public and the public gets to see it?
That's a great place to start, Jeff. This is something that I think most of us and most people in the country thought would be a slam dunk, that it changes people's behavior and that it's a good thing and that there should be no reason why we shouldn't have access to these things, especially since people are recording these things on their own devices and this stuff comes out. The complications are several. One is, and I think the main one, is that the situations in which officers find themselves often involve people at their worst moments in circumstances where it would be devastating for the public to have access. And there are other aspects of it as well, but one concern that really resonated with me was law enforcement officers saying, "We're concerned that people won't call us when they need us because they don't want to see their circumstance on the evening news." So it's a wicked problem in that sense. There's definitely pros and cons. There's also concerns about whether people will be biased or criminal investigation or a criminal trial would be harmed by having all this information be out. So those are some of the issues that people have.
So the way that we balance those interests in transparency on the one hand and privacy and the integrity of investigations on the other hand, to some extent, is through our public records law. We've just had a change in law in that area as it pertains to body-worn camera footage. So let's start by talking about what the law was before the change. So a month ago, what was the kind of overall big picture of how the public records law applied to this footage?
So North Carolina has a very broad public records law, which basically makes all public records, records relating to the transaction of public business, public, available to anybody to inspect or have a copy of, unless an exception applies. And there is a pretty broad exception for criminal investigation and intelligence records. And pretty much everything that would be covered on a body-worn camera recording would fall within that. You and I have talked about the possibility if somebody is, an officer is stop to help somebody change a tire. Perhaps that's not a criminal investigation record, but most things that would be captured would be covered by that exception. That exception says that the records of criminal investigations are not public records. What that means in the structure of our statute is that the public doesn't have a right of access to them, but the law enforcement agency is not prohibited from releasing them. So it really leaves it up to the law enforcement agency to release them.
So at least all the footage that people would be really interested in, footage of officer-involved shootings or the footage of criminal activity afoot, that's all going to fall within this exception for records of criminal investigation. It's going to be up to the agency whether to release it. There's also an overlay about the personnel records statute, right?
Yeah, and that was the most difficult aspect of the law as it was before the recent change. Personnel records, records that public agencies gather with respect to their employees, are confidential. And to the extent that there is a record that is used in a disciplinary action or where the issue for the agency is whether the employee performed appropriately, which of course is always the issue in some of these really controversial incidents, those records would be confidential. And unlike the criminal investigation statute, the agency is prohibited from releasing them. And so it wasn't clear under the law whether these records would be personnel records or not. And so there was really a need for some clarification on that issue.
So enter the new law. In the 2016 legislative session, the General Assembly passed and Governor McCrory has recently signed a bill that changes how we regulate body-worn camera footage, and it creates two different tiers or types of public access. What are the two basic ways that you can get access under the new law?
Yeah, this is a new thing under our law. That the notion is that they've created two levels. One is disclosure. Disclosure means you can view and listen to the record, but you don't have the right to copy it. Under the new law, only people who are depicted in the recording have an opportunity to request that.
So if I'm a motorist who's been subjected to a traffic stop and I contend that the officer used inappropriate language with me during the stop, I could go to the agency and say, I want to see the video of that stop so I can confirm exactly what I think the officer said. Is that basically the gist of disclosure?
That's right.
And then there's this other category that you were about to talk about before I interrupted you. So what's that?
Okay. The other one is actually release, and that means getting a copy. And the new statute places responsibility for the release, for authorizing the release of the actual recording. Superior Court has that responsibility. So anybody who wants a copy, an actual copy of it to do with whatever they want, they can appeal to Superior Court to get that copy.
So if I'm a media member and I'm interested in the body-worn camera footage of an officer-involved shooting, it's not the route that I take now isn't to ask the agency for it. The route that I take is to ask a court to order the agency to give it to me.
That's right.
What kind of considerations does a court consider in deciding whether to give it to me or not?
So going back to disclosure for a moment, the only people who are depicted or their representatives can ask for disclosure. It's not an automatic right. They can request it and nobody else can. So the press can't request disclosure in that setting. A person depicted can. And the statute lists a series of factors that the law enforcement agency has to consider in determining whether to allow disclosure. That is a list of about six things that really covers the kinds of concerns and interests that people have that I talked about that makes this such a difficult area. It lists things like factors such as whether there's sensitive personal information in there, whether it would harm the reputation or jeopardize the safety of a person, whether it's a threat to the fair administration of justice, or whether it would affect an internal ongoing criminal investigation or internal investigation or procedure.
So that list of factors is something that the agency applies in this disclosure context.
Right.
When a person wants to see themselves on the video, the agency applies that list of factors And if the person thinks the agency has balanced those wrongly and has denied disclosure and they still want to see it, is there some right of appeal to a court?
Right. Then they can appeal to the court. And the court and the agency would have to determine whether that's a person who's eligible under the statute to have disclosure. And getting back to your original question, that same set of factors is the set of factors that the court would be required to apply in the case of someone, anyone, asking for a court order to release it.
So for disclosure, only a person depicted can get disclosure. They ask the agency for disclosure. The agency balances the factors. If the person doesn't like how they were balanced, they appeal to a court. For release, anybody can ask for release, but they have to ask a court, not the agency, and the court goes ahead and applies the factors in the first instance. Is that basically it?
That's exactly right. And the court can also create limitations on the release, so they can say that they're going to release it, but you have to use it only for these purposes.
It seems like there's potential for a lot of court involvement and a lot of work for the courts in refereeing these decisions.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think that now that it's clear what the process is, people may be interested in getting these. I do expect that it would be a pretty significant part of the Superior Court docket in the future.
So last question, as you look at the big picture about the new legislation, I've read these media accounts where a lot of folks are dissatisfied and feel like the new statute is taking these out of the public records law and making them less accessible. Do you think overall that the new statute is a step towards greater transparency or towards greater privacy or some mix of both?
Well, I think that the choice of the court as the entity to, in the most cases, decide what gets released and to balance those interests is a good choice in the sense that I think most people would assume that the court would be more neutral with respect to the interests of public balanced against the interests of the employees of the agency. So I think in that sense, it may be that people will have a better sense of the fairness of the decision. On the other side, however, I think that having to file a lawsuit that involves resources, it takes time, and it may be perceived and it may actually be a barrier, as opposed to just having to file a public records request.
Great. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Jeff Welty back at Podcast Headquarters. That concludes this episode of Beyond the Bench. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, be sure to subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or Stitcher, where you can listen to all of our podcast episodes. Most importantly, leave us a review. Positive feedback helps other people find out about our show. If you have any topics you think we should cover or people you think should be interviewed here on Beyond the Bench, pitch us. We'd love to hear from you. You can email me at welty@sog.unc.edu or producer Danielle Rivenbark at danielle.p@sog.unc.edu. More information about the show is available on the podcast website at podcast.sog.unc.edu. Hope to see you back in 2 weeks with our next episode of Beyond the Bench. That show will feature an interview with Superior Court Judge Carl Fox. This is your host, Jeff Welty. Podcast adjourned.